Off the ball.
Jamie caught Frank with quite a bad challenge and the physio's patching him up, and Les Seeley, his turn turned to Frank. He went, Frank, get back on and do him good and proper. He said he took a liberty there. He said, make sure you leave it on him good and proper. And I'm stood there, I'm thinking, oh, hang on. He's talking about him doing my... This ain't right, you know?
Off the ball.
Weeknights from 7 and weekends from 1.
This is OTB Sports Radio. Live 24-7 on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Just a reminder that our Nollaig na Mban takeover today is brought to you in association with Lidl. More for you in 2021. See Lidl.ie/healthy. And we're now moving on to our weekly Sunday paper review, and I'm in the company of Cliona Foley and Maureen Eve Raynine. And just very quickly before I go to the ladies, I'll just give you a quick run through of the headlines of all the sports headlines at the moment. So we'll start off with the Sunday Independent, and it has Munster scramble home and French withdrawal leaves rugby season in chaos. That's obviously going to be something that people are going to be very much interested in and talking about over the next few days and weeks, I'm sure, as people scrabble to make arrangements and wonder if it's going to happen. But look, 2020 managed to get things happening, so hopefully 2021 will also follow suit. The Sunday Times have Demolition Derby on their front page, and they're talking about obviously the FA magic. We always talk about is the magic of the FA Cup gone? Not if you're from Chorley. And Dove exit followed Kenny's call to stay on. That's an interesting story there by Paul Rowan, which you should get to later hopefully. And also, French alert on COVID threatens Six Nations. The Irish Sunday Mirror also has a Six Nations COVID chaos, as they call it. Lampard, he's talking about punishing the COVID idiots. He's talking about players who break COVID rules and regulations should be punished and hit them in their pockets, and tougher disciplinary action is what he calls for. And there's also a headline here about freeze Spurs out. Turn off the heating and stick Jose stars in tiny dressing room, says Marines Raven. Obviously, we've just heard from Jose there earlier, saying that he was very worried about the facilities there and whether his players would be able to deal with it. And you could argue if they're as elite as he says they are, that won't be an issue for them. Sunday World, their back page. Artful Dodger, Gunners, Pickpocket Magpies. And also a story here about Leisbeek will consider offers, but can Poole afford him? So it's interesting how things are still going on in that department. The Star on Sunday, they're gone with the FA Cup as well, obviously, and the routing of Derby yesterday. I mean, whether COVID or not played a role, and that doesn't matter. The magic of the FA Cup remains. And the Irish Mail on Sunday. On the brink, Six Nations in doubt, with French set to pull plug for Europe, and Munster cling on in Galway dogfight. It was an amazing finish, that game. It finished Connacht 10, Munster 16. If you didn't get to see it, don't bother watching it. Just go for the last few minutes. You get all the action there. And finally, the last paper I have in my hand here is the Sun Sport, and it's buy now, pay later. Ozil offers installment plan. So basically that is the continuing saga of Mesut Ozil and the payment plan and his future or non-future at Arsenal. So let's get to it. Cliona Foley, August Moore and Eve Raynon, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Maureen.
Thanks much, Asa.
First time I've spoken to you ladies in a long time, actually, just with COVID and everything else going on. But there's so much actually going on in the papers. And actually, it's something to be said for all the papers that even when there's very little sport happening, they've managed to keep churning out the stuff. So let's get right to it. And I suppose uncertainty, Cliona, is the name of the game. We've just saw a brief look there of the headlines. We don't know about the Six Nations. We don't know about the Champions Cup and even the Olympics, even though they were pushed back a year. Still a big question mark.
Yeah, and interesting, I was doing a piece about the Olympics for the Sunday Independent today, but even just, I think, the day after I had finished that piece, Japan declared a state of emergency and, you know, brought in a new lockdown. So, look, it's a movable feast, that's all we can say. We don't know. Shane McGrath has some good stuff in the Mail on Sunday today. And one of the things he noticed is Dick Pound, who'd be a member of the International Olympic Committee, coming out and saying that, you know, athletes should be moved up the vaccine queue, and the headline of Shane's opinion piece is carrying special torch for sport is just wrong. And actually, interesting enough, Canadian athletes have since come out and said, we don't see why we should be ahead of people who are far more, you know, worthy of getting vaccines early. But there have been some bizarre, even I noticed even in England this week, wasn't one of the English football managers saying that players should get vaccines early so that they can be ruled out and therefore more impetus can be given to whoever needs it in the NHS system. So look, nothing is straightforward. And as we know, everything is changing day to day, really.
Yeah, just that article there actually about carrying special torch for sport is just wrong. I can see why, Maude, why people, I suppose managers, would try to make that argument. They'd argue for peace of mind, ensuring that games can go on so thousands and millions can watch it and enjoy themselves. But you can kind of see Shane McGrath's argument as well, saying, you know, you can't be injecting the world's healthiest people at the expense of vulnerable people sitting in houses, sitting in hospitals and nursing homes.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose he makes a great point where he says, you know, there is a protocol there in place. There is, you know, a situation for everybody worldwide where they need to have a plan there. And you can't kind of just change that and say, well, we really want live sport to continue on. We've a crisis here in our hands and let's try and speed up the vaccines. And I suppose if the running order doesn't follow the way it's meant to, chaos can ensue then as well. But a big point that he makes, I suppose, is that it is something that people will look forward to for live sport, but it's not going to be an instant kind of gratification that you'll get. And I suppose the research with vaccines, everything needs to be followed. But definitely you can see people's appetite there, Marchesa, for live sport. But I think we can all agree with his opinion that it can't just be rolled out for the sake of it without maybe the most vulnerable being first.
And like, there's an appetite for everything, really. I think at this stage there's an appetite just to go out into a cafe and be bumped in the back by somebody at this point.
Well, that's very true. And
go ahead, Mark.
But you would see, I suppose, even with people to say there's an appetite for getting back to what they would have done before. I think people have maybe changed what they put their priorities on as well and what they kind of see as most important. But definitely in a social sense, people are going to look forward to being able to see live sport. If they can leave their home to go to work, I think they'll see that a great benefit to be able to see their family. And all of these things need to be taken into account, that while it is a big emphasis on sport and live sport, people will look forward to that hope, I suppose, that 2021 will bring of more hope that we can have in our normal situations, life and personal life as well.
Marchesa, one of the things I noticed was, you know, we'll talk about the rugby situation probably in a few minutes, but I noticed in England this week, and there's a piece in the Sun on Sunday on women's football and the influence or the effect that some players going abroad at Christmas against regulations has caused. And Birmingham City, which I thought there's a lot of dual standards, really, I think, in some of this coverage. Like, you know, I feel that if women's players went abroad for whatever reason, that should be highlighted just as much as men's players. It wasn't covered. It didn't get as much coverage, I think, as the men's did. And there were arguments about it. Man City and Arsenal players went abroad they were, well, actually, technically only two female players have been named, I noticed, in the coverage. And one of them is Ireland's Katie McCabe. And the argument was that some of the players went abroad on business reasons. But whatever the reasons about it, the knock-on effect is very interesting and the ethics it raises is very interesting. And because London clubs were the ones who were banned from travelling, if you like, but other clubs, you know, were advised not to travel. And in fact, the Manchester United women's manager is the only person who has come out and made any case for an apology. And I think that's interesting as well. So, but the story today that has come out is that Birmingham women's team in the Women's Super League, they've pulled out of a game today against Spurs, right? Because they only have 10 players fit due to injuries and one player testing positive. But the FA said that they look like they're going to deduct points off them. So it raises this whole thing about the depth of women's squads, the reasons for this. The Carla Ward, as the Birmingham manager, was saying, you know, we've just had an extraordinary run of injuries and this COVID problem, so we feel it'd be irresponsible. And it's one of five Women's Super League matches to be axed today. So Everton, Manchester United, Aston Villa and Brighton have all had games called off because of it. And I just thought, you know, we should be seeing more coverage of this. You know, if women's football it deserves to be covered equally, then we should see equal coverage of it and equally hard questions asked of it.
And it's not happening. And do you think, Cliona and Maura, is that just because, let's call a spade, nobody cares enough to give out about them?
It's well, certainly... Yeah, go ahead, Mar.
Sorry, Cian. You know, just I think in a big way there is increased coverage of women's sport, but I think the opinions that go along with it, until people are maybe more sure of what the impact would be in a financial way with clubs, with international matches going ahead, sometimes they're afraid maybe to raise this issue, to bring it up until they have all the facts from it. But I don't think that should mean that people shy away from talking about it and from discussing. If it's there to happen, players are going to be injured, they're going to have COVID, if they need to self-isolate or they're not available for matches, it is something that should be raised rather than saying we'll just wait till we know more and then bring it up at a later stage.
And waiting to know more as well, actually, Cliona, you're doing a Jesus act on us today in that you're talking about the papers and you're in the papers, you're omnipresent. And I see you've an article in the Sunday Independent about how Tokyo and the road is no smoother, is the headline, because people just don't know. And the Olympics, and interestingly enough, there has been surveys done amongst the Japanese, and people in Japan are, you know, support of the Olympics is slowly eroding as their levels of COVID are on the up.
Yeah, and I'm not the only one. Sean McGoldrick in the Sunday World and Shane McGrath has a piece on this today. And there's lots of people, because it's just under 200 days until Tokyo Olympics, the postponed Tokyo Olympics should be going ahead. And I just was talking to a few athletes, because it's just the nuances of this are very interesting. Like, I think we have something like 52 Irish athletes qualified, but like we'd have a load of athletes who are hoping to qualify. And some of them don't even know what the international calendar is. The qualification tournaments keep getting moved. So I was interested as to how that influences them at the moment and how they're thinking. And when you talk to them, they all say, oh, it's brilliant. I've had an extended period of training at home and I'm training really hard. But like, my point is, athletes live on competition. That's what gets them through the dog days. And they don't have any of that competition. And I spoke to a number of people for the Sunday Independent today, including Colin Judge, a Paralympic table tennis player. And like, when you see and hear the reality of their lives, you know, the axle on his wheelchair broke this week. And because of COVID, there was a backlog trying to get it fixed. And he only had one chair. His life was affected, not just his sport. But also things like, you know, qualification tournaments being moved, not knowing. He doesn't even know. He knows the next Olympic qualifier for him is in April, but the international calendar for para table tennis isn't out until next week, and they don't know whether it's going to come out next week. So you have this constant rolling tension. Jenny Egan I spoke to as well. The boxers are back. The boxers, the Irish elite boxers, were meant to be going to England this month for a two-week training session. That's had to go. And just... high performance managers and athletes are just constantly tearing up their plans and rewriting them at the moment. And I just think that must be incredibly stressful.
It must be. And also, like, not every athlete is 20 years old. There's a few people there who are at the sunset of their careers as well, Maura. And they just about maybe managed to carry the bridge over from 2020 to 2021. It could be a big ask for a few people to keep training for 2022 and stay good enough to qualify.
Well, that's very true. And when you think about the Olympics as well, with a four-year process, it's not even just the training would be from that. A lot of the time it can be for two series of the Olympics, even three. And so you're talking about maybe a lack of preparation for some player, for some of the athletes as well, where they maybe didn't have the same ability to train, the same access to facilities. And I suppose for some, it might depend on the sport that they were able to continue on. But if you need specific training facilities, particular place that you would go to, and that wasn't available during lockdown or wasn't available due to COVID, it really means that they have been at a big disadvantage. And it's hard to make up that time again, because internationally the situation has been different. Some countries can be ahead of others and maybe have had more of a chance to return to that training and that preparation.
Will the Olympics happen? Get your crystal ball out now.
Yeah, I actually might have left that bit at home there, but no, I think in a big way with the Olympics, it's the same as everything. We're hoping for the best. We're trying to be optimistic and see what is possible. But at the moment, you need to be realistic as well as being optimistic. And I think, you know, when they look at it with the safety of, and also the preparation that athletes will have had, you need to give athletes a fair chance to give their best crack at it as well, that they're not just going to be thrown into the middle of something for the sake of it happening as well.
And even if they do go ahead empty, they're going to be very, very different. Mm. Not just for the athletes, because the athletes know now that they, you know, they won't have the same amount of time in the Olympic Village. They'll have to come in very close to their competition and get out very quickly afterwards. We don't know really, you know, spectators, how much time will they have, you know, all that. Anybody who's ever been to, if you were lucky enough to get to London 2012, even people will know, you know, that time that you spend around the Olympic Village, bumping into people that you know from home, talking about the performances you've just seen, going to something that you may thought you'd never have gone to see before. All of that Olympic experience is going to be very, very different, even if they do go ahead.
And the other thing that's going to be very different as well, if the back pages are anything to go by, is the Six Nations, a massive question mark there as well, Cliona.
Yeah, and the potential knock on again, Martha, for, you know, if Six Nations doesn't go ahead, or I mean, the big worry at the moment is the European Cup, because the French government have warned their clubs against playing English clubs. And so we're looking now at the potential for things to be cancelled. It's only a month away, actually, until the Six Nations start. And kudos to Brendan Fanning on the front page of the Sunday Independent supplement today for mentioning the fact that the women's Six Nations is also being mentioned. So little coverage. You see this. Cian Tracy did a very good job during the week as well on the Irish Independent. He was talking about what could happen to Irish rugby this year. And he also doubled it up with the women's coverage. So that's great to see that's happening. And Brendan says it here because he said, and this is the first time I've actually seen this in print, but it may be out there. It's understood that the women's Six Nations will be refixed for April and May, while the under 20 Six Nations could be back until next summer. Mm-hmm. But the problem is if you and the Lions Tour is the other element as well of it, you know, and this notion, there's quite a few pieces in the papers today about what should happen to the Lions Tour, because we know South Africa now is the source of potentially, you know, another variation on this awful disease. So if it doesn't go ahead in South Africa, there's big arguments today in the papers about should it go ahead at all, or should it be moved to UK and Ireland to host it? So there's just a knock-on effect of everything. I mean, God, who'd be a sports administrator at the moment? It must be absolutely hellish. I mean, obviously the real hell is for the people who are working on the front line. But if you work in sport and, you know, you're working in logistics of sport at the moment internationally, it's a tough time. So that's the big worry, is that if the French, you know, if things start to get moved, then there's going to be a knock-on effect. And as I said, some of the European Cup games are going to get delayed. And then how far down the road does that knock them? And then what happens as well? Will the Six Nations start in a month's time?
It's a good question. I thought it was very interesting, actually, when I read Brendan Fanning's piece there about how, you know, they're talking about the concerns France has around the UK variant and the postponement of the last three games of top 14. And then there are claims that their COVID issues started by fulfilling a European Challenge Cup fixture at home to Leicester Tigers a week before Christmas. And I didn't realise this because obviously every country and every region has their own regulations. France is currently under curfew, either 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. or 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. depending on the region. And further restrictions are expected this week. Despite the rampant COVID figures across Europe, both EPCR and Six Nations will be under pressure to get some form of competitive rugby over the line to meet their commitment to broadcasters and sponsors. And Maude, that is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And there was actually another point that Brendan Fanning made there as well, that, you know, the Munster-Leinster game, which was postponed on Stephen's Day, would technically be able to go ahead then, because that January 22nd, 23rd weekend would then be freed up. But I suppose when you think of advertising, when you think of the lack of ticket sales that have been there for all of the matches, it has a huge knock-on effect for the industry of sport as well. The IRFU are in serious trouble with the bills that they have to pay. And again, when you think of professional sport, it's important to remember that as players are paid, advertisers are in the same way. All the sponsors, it's very difficult because money is tight in a lot of areas. But it creates a logistical nightmare for trying to, as Cliona mentioned as well, anybody in organising sport would know that. But in broadcasting as well, it's very hard to put a schedule together that allows to say when a match will be happening or when it won't, to put a broadcast team and production team together when it's all just kind of hidden hope, I suppose, that it might happen. But definitely from a logistical point of view and planning, it's going to be very tough.
And after all that, you know, as well, when you think about all the doom and gloom and the question marks, and you wonder what else could come and surprise us. Speaking of Brendan Fanning, he has another article on the Inside. And, you know, if ever you're looking for a bit of positivity in the world of rugby, I suppose, especially if you're a Paul O'Connell fan, is that Paul O'Connell is back.
Yeah, and obviously this story has been covered, you know, in the last few days as well. But Brendan's piece is a good piece, I think, in that it does ask some, you know, what you expect of Sunday papers. It asks some harder questions about his move, about why he's there, about, you know, what he's done in the past in coaching and what the long-term aim is. You know, the assumption that he's just in there to work under the line-out is really interesting. I thought it was a very interesting line. Was it from, I'm trying to think who had it, in the in the Sunday Times, I think Peter O'Reilly has a very interesting line. I mean, he actually says this, and I people would be interested. It's an opinion, clearly, but he says this line that he says Paul O'Connell wouldn't have taken the job unless he believed he would eventually replace Andy Farrell,
yes,
which I think is a very interesting line. It just jumped out at me. So both himself and Brendan Fanning have good pieces on that.
I thought actually there was a line in that Peter O'Reilly article which I thought was very interesting, and is something that I think people will be watching with breath that is bated, is that Ireland supporters used to rejoice in the notion of O'Connell as a player with superhuman powers, but a superhuman coach, let's see. And that's the thing, isn't it? Many's a superhuman player, does not become a superhuman coach. He's putting his legacy on the line, really, by taking that kind of gig.
Yeah, and Sinead Cassan had a very interesting line yesterday, I think, in the Saturday's Independent as well. And she was saying, she said O'Connell wasn't like any other player. And he's been fast-tracked as a coach, unlike any other coach. So that will put a lot of pressure on him. And the Irish line-out and the Irish forwards are going to be watched very carefully. But I think anybody who really is interested in rugby and sort of the power structures of Irish rugby and who was in place when Andy Farrell came in, Brendan Fanning's, looks deeply at sort of the backroom team that he's arguing wasn't particularly well organised when the new Irish management, when Andy took over, and he's questioning that, and he's looking at what happened since and where he thinks O'Connell is going to fit into that. But it is a big challenge.
And you'd be wondering Brendan has it here, this is not risk-free for Paul O'Connell. It is attractive financially, especially at a time when the Lions tour, from which he would have had a media gig, is hanging by a thread. The challenge for him is threefold. Fix the line-out, which means developing a few line-out leaders who are comfortable seeing it the way he does. Restore the clarity and technique Ireland had of the breakdown under Joe Schmidt and fit into a coaching group where everyone is territorial. That's a whole heap of work. And you'd be wondering, Maura, has he been clouded perhaps by the fact that, and obviously we don't know this, we don't know Paul O'Connell, we don't know what his thinking was, but his thinking perhaps maybe been clouded by, I have no income coming in here, here's a good gig, or do you think it's more long-term than that?
I think it's more long term. Like Brendan Fanning had brought up three questions, where one of them he was saying whose idea was it, but the second one was why did Paul O'Connell accept this offer? And I suppose you'd have to say, from a basic point of view, Paul O'Connell was always such a strong player, such determination from him, and he would relish a challenge, whether it was as a player or then going into management. And I'd have to agree with Cliona that it definitely, when you look at the lineup that they're going to have to fix, the challenges that he has from it, it's definitely a challenge I think he would rise to. But from a financial point of view, as I said, the IRFU have a lot of problems, as do World Rugby. And he definitely, I suppose, would see that maybe if he can help increase the play, improve the play, that it's going to be something financially that will benefit him. But it's something that I'd say he wouldn't shy away from the challenge, Martasa. And they're saying he'll have to move fast to stay afloat, but I think he's someone that can definitely swim when he's thrown in the deep end.
But the third question, Cliona, that Brendan asks, will it work? Will it work?
Well, do you know what? Wouldn't you draw comparisons between him going in there and Damien Duff's departure from the FAI this week?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't always make an assumption that a brilliant player, a devoted international, somebody who seems to have nerves of steel and the stomach for any fight, you can't always assume that, one, they're going to be brilliant coaches, and two, and Duff apparently has a really good reputation as a coach, but two, that they're going to fit into a team, a team of management. And this is the big question, because everybody is shocked that Damien Duff has left the FAI so quickly, and there's a lot of pieces about that in today's papers as well.
There is, and actually there's a piece in the front page of the Sunday Times by Paul Rowan. Duff exit followed Kenny's call to stay on. Now obviously we can only take Paul Rowan's word for this, but as people who do know Paul, I suppose, and know the work he's done when it comes to the FAI and stuff, you'd have to expect that his sources are full on. And I suppose, however, on Friday it became clear that Duff was sticking by his decision that he no longer wanted to work for the FAI after the way Kenny was treated in the urgent inquiry that followed November's friendly. The investigation followed a complaint made about a video shown by Kenny to the players, followed by a lengthy talk that dealt with aspects of Irish history, which was said to be verging on anti-English. Duff made his anger known about the inquiry when he was interviewed as part of the process by the outgoing interim chief executive Gary Owens, and it is thought that he was prepared to resign if any action was taken against Kenny. His departure has surprised the FAI hierarchy. The inquiry cleared of Kenny of any wrongdoing, and Owens has left the FAI after a lengthy handover period. So Paul Rowan is saying that Damien Duff left because he couldn't couldn't stomach how Kenny was treated. Now, obviously, Damien Duff has not come out and expressly said this, but like you just said, Cliona, he is a man who knows his own mind and is not afraid to act on it.
Yeah, like it's a fascinating story, but none of us know the truth of it until Damien Duff actually explains why he left, and he may never do that.
Does he need to help Stephen Kenny out of this kind of quagmire and tittle-tattle, or do we just need to move on the bus now?
Well, Philip Quinn also has a very good piece as well. Unfortunately, for whatever his reasons, you know, the optics of it are not good. Because he was, you know, the third in command, if you like, in Stephen Kenny, who's under pressure already because of results. And it really doesn't look. Philip Quinn has a very good piece as well, I think. There's a couple of good pieces. Paul Roan is very good on this. And this notion that it was over Wembley Gate and, you know, the FAI having that investigation, that has been suggested by several people as the reason. But other people are poo-pooing it and saying they don't think it's the key to it. Philip Quinn's piece interests me because he talks about, he's taking the story on, if you like, and he's saying who could come in, who's going to replace him. We don't know why he's gone, but who could replace him? Vinnie Perth has been mentioned, obviously, who worked beside Kenny in Dundalk. John O'Shea is mentioned because he is finishing, I think he's just about to finish his UEFA pro licence. Brian Kerr, if they want somebody who has, you know, respect and maturity and longevity in the game and still knows the game very well. So he's talking about that. But what he does say is the decision of the third in command in the Ireland setup to walk away doesn't reflect well on anyone, not Kenny, not Duff, not the FAI, nor the dented reputation. Those watching from afar may be excused for thinking if Duffer wanted out, there must be a lot bad, you know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, he may have done it for what he people clearly always take things, make decisions for what they think are the right reasons. But how it appears to others, and it appears about an organisation that's already under pressure and a management that's already under pressure, you know, that is a problem.
And I suppose that's it, isn't it? We are just speaking in a vacuum and we don't know. And maybe we're worse for talking when we don't know. And we should just maybe keep our mouth shut until we do know something. Which I suppose if we did that, Cliona and Mona, we'd have nothing to talk about. Exactly. Just to get back to the rugby there, just got a text in there. Great to see Polly on board. Half the job done. Now to get Roger on board. That comes in from Minnie Nihay. And if you want to chat to us at any point, do feel free to send us a text to 53106 or all our social channels. They're on at Off the Ball as well. And we've got plenty more coming up as well for the paper review. That's only just scratched the surface of it. We've just done a little bit of rugby, a little bit of soccer, a little bit of what ifs. There's still a lot more to come from Cliona Foley and from Árni Vrenon. So please do stay with us because we're going to be back with more paper review after this break. Fáil Tadash, thank you very much for joining us on our Nollag na Mban takeover. It's brought you in association with Lidl. More for you in 2021 for Lidl's great range of healthy recipes and products. To kickstart the new year, check out lidl.ie/healthy. The FA Cup is going on today. Just a few scores rolling in at the moment or where they stand at the moment. At the moment, I'm just looking here. Bristol City 1, Portsmouth 0. Mansfield Town is currently ahead of Cheltenham Town 1-0 and 2-0. For Manchester City up against Birmingham. They're the scores I have at the moment coming in. But let's get back to our pay-per-view and Cliona Foley and Árni Vrenon standing by. Máire, I'll go to you now. And obviously we had so many retirements from the Mayo camp over the last few days that I think one poor people in Mayo were wondering, jeepers, what's going to happen next? But really it gives all of us a chance to reminisce about, I suppose, the good times they gave the GAA fan over the last decade.
Yeah, definitely. And a point was made to me during the week there that Old Moore's almanac was released. And one of the predictions from last year was that Donald Trump wouldn't win the election. And one for 2021 is that Mayo will win the All-Ireland. So I'm not sure if the four in question saw that prediction before they took the retirement decision. But definitely they've given Mayo some service. And you'd have to say, Mortasa, the heart they have shown as players in struggling through disappointment and continuing to reinvent themselves to come back again, you know, it's definitely something to be reckoned with. But I suppose with every disappointment that they had, the panel was still changing. And a good point that was made actually in Dermot Crowe's article there today was kind of the continuity that, you know, that existed there instead of it being changed and Horan saying, well, I'm going to change everything up and just bring in a new crop of players. We have a great set of under-20s coming in. He wanted to gel the players, to blend them and mould them together. And I think that did stand to them. 10 minutes to the final whistle against Dublin, they were still in the game. You know, it wasn't a case that they had lost it from the first minute, even though that goal from Dean Rock and obviously breaking records there was huge. But it did show the, you know, they said to the Mayo Barn, and I suppose to that cause, they were always answering that call.
I find Cliona, whenever I think about Mayo and their travails and the journeys they've gone on, and yes, it's heartbreaking, yes, it's devastation, but maybe it's the romantic in me. I think I'd rather, it is better to have loved and lost to never have loved at all. And I just think there's so many counties around the country, people in Longford, people in Wicklow, yeah, people who would love to feel that heartbreak. Mayo have given their county so much, yeah, despite not reaching that pinnacle. It's about the journey, not the destination. Now, people who don't win All-Irelands mightn't agree with me, but you know what, yeah, I mean?
I absolutely agree with you. And actually, the one nice thing I think that's happened this week is that all of these Mayo players, and Dennis Walsh has a lovely piece in Sunday Times today, and he has a list of the most appearances for Mayo Championship League. It starts with Andy Moran at 183, and he comes down as far as Donal Vaughan, just because these are the ones who have retired, 117, Dave Clark, 133. But what I think is interesting, and what was nice this week, is that they get the recognition, because they played so much because they were so successful. The only thing they didn't do was win bloody All-Ireland, right? But they were so often there. They've played an incredible amount. They've shown incredible resilience. But what I like is that they're getting recognition for that resilience, and also because they seem to be players themselves who appreciate that, who appreciate that it wasn't just about winning, that even though they had horrendous heartache. And I just, Tom Parsons this week, he did a lovely interview with Joe on Off the Ball, but has done a few really lovely interviews over the week. You know, that has been his message, was that I got so much from sport, you know, even though I had the heartaches, I still learned so much from sport, and it was such a huge thing in my life. I think that's brilliant. And actually, I think there's, if you like, almost, it's almost that other people don't get that recognition. So I really liked the fact that in the Sun today, Jason Byrne does a list of the people who retired this week. So he includes people like Graham Riley from Meath, your own Brad in Galway, Mike Brad's, Cullen's best.
Yeah, Brad's Bradshaw gone. At least he got an All-Ireland medal as well, though, with Mike Cullen. Or should, yeah, I say a county medal, All-Ireland, I'm elevating them naturally.
Which shows what the importance of Galway in your heart. Kai Cooney in Tyrone. And one that really caught my eye was, and I saw somebody else referring to him this week, and that is he played for Wicklow. He was the Wicklow captain for the last few years, and he has just retired. And the fact that I can't even, his name won't come to me now, just tells you that in some ways, you know, some people get all the credit they deserve, and then some people don't get the credit they deserve. And so I thought, you know, you'd love to see them all get the sort of attention, if you like, that.
Well, not if you're Joe Brawley, who has an article above giving out about that exactly, yeah, people getting, yeah, flowers and platitudes. But it's not an opinion I'd agree with. I think if you want to send your statement out, say, thanks a million, I've retired, or if you want to quietly slink away, that's your choice. And it's not your fault if people tell you you're great, is my attitude on that. But actually, when you talk about platitudes, Cliona, the Dermot Crowe article, Maud, I know you were a big fan of it earlier. I just thought the bit about David Clark and how last summer Clark spoke of the efforts he made to get back into the team during lockdown in 2020, having lost his place towards the end of the 2019 championship to Robbie Hennelly. The interview was given to Liam Swit of Roche Ireland, and it goes on to go on to say Clark said he roped his wife in to throw the ball at him when practicing at home, and had his two daughters involved in yoga online sessions along with the training regime prescribed by the Mayo management. His longevity was remarkable, as was the pendulum swing of his fortunes. He swung in and out of that team, and it wasn't an easy journey for him, and he still only looks like he's 12 years old. I was amazed to see he was 37.
Yeah, he's had an amazing career, and I suppose even as we mentioned earlier with Tom Parsons and coming back from his horrific injury playing Galway in the Connacht Championship in 2018, it definitely was a massive return for him to see him even be able to be back on a panel, never mind to be back on an inter-county panel and be able to come back on the pitch. But I think with David Clark, people will often say that maybe goalkeepers have a longer lifespan of players than perhaps an outfield player, but I don't think that's true. A huge amount of dedication is demanded. You know, you still need to have the same physical fitness from it and to be mentally tough, especially we know that in Mayo All-Ireland with own goals being scored, everything from it, to come back and be able to recover from that takes huge resilience and strength. And I think as a character, being 37 years of age, his debut, I was reading, from 2005 against Roscommon, that's a huge lifespan of playing with the team as well as continuing to play with his club. And he mentioned there that his family, his wife and his children were all helping out with it. But that's what the GAA is. It's a family. It's a community. And while it's your own family as well, it just shows how dedicated and loyal he was to the green and red as well.
Just got another text in here. People are obviously very taken by Paul O'Connell's return. Philip from Donegal has texted in to say on 53106, I think it's fantastic for the Irish team, particularly the younger players, that Paul O'Connell has joined the Irish setup. His stature is such that he could pick and choose any job he wants, so to get him on the Irish ticket is great news, especially if he gets to work on a very poorly functioning line-out. So do keep your comments coming in at Off the Ball or 53106. Another surprise, Cliona, that came up during the week, and Eamon Sweeney has a big write-up on it on the back page in the Sunday Independent. That is about Cork's new sponsor.
Yeah, there's in terms of two news stories for the GAA this week, one of them was this new sponsorship, the Sport Direct with Cork, and the other one was about counties training when they shouldn't be training. And Dennis Walsh has a good piece on that in the Sunday Times. People might want to look at that. But the Eamon Sweeney one is really interesting. Like, we know at this stage that sport, you know, is such a contradiction now. It is, because it's big business, even though it is the GAA, which, you know, we believe to be amateur in the heart of all of our, a lot of our communities, you know, it is the point as well where sport intersects with business, because it can't operate without money. And so this piece, because the owner, obviously, of Sports Direct is Mike Ashley, who owns Newcastle, and his company have had very questionable work practices in the past. And Eamon looks at those and looks at, you know, why Cork would get involved with a company of this nature. And he also says, look, a lot of people say this is sport now, and that's my feeling about it. But what you certainly would hope that when anybody takes on a sponsor, they do look at their work practices, they look to see that everything is done properly. And he goes through in great detail, actually, the history of Sports Direct, because they came before a British government, a House of Commons Business Innovation Skills Committee, I think it was 2006, if I remember correctly. And he is saying that just last year, the Labour Party put it second on a list of quote-unquote bad bosses who promoted insecure and unsafe work in Britain. Having promised the time of the inquiry to end zero-hour contracts, the company was back hiring workers on that basis in Scotland last summer. The problem is that a lot of big companies, you know, including ones in this country, you know, do give out zero-hour contracts, and work practices are not what we would wish them to be. So there is some contradiction in sport, and there is huge contradiction in a lot of things about sport, including the Olympic movement, you know, including things like this. I suppose his point is that, you know, this is GAA, and he's questioning why, I suppose, a GAA county board would, you know, to use another thing, get in bed with a company that does have a questionable history.
I think the headline, Mona, in itself is quite stark. It catches you. No excuse for rebels taking Ashley's soup. And then he has a paragraph in it where he says, arguing that Cork are right to make the deal because Sports Direct are offering lots of money is just standard right-wing political ideology masquerading as common sense. The idea that it's not just a right but a duty to maximise profit in every circumstance is responsible for the worst features of Irish society. It's what fuels the extortionate rents and soaring property prices which make life tough for so many people. It drove the intensive lobbying campaign by business organisations which persuaded the government to go against NPHET's public health advice in December with disastrous consequences. And it's responsible for a situation where the government are bringing in a new house purchase scheme which will actually increase property prices and the level of indebtedness amongst buyers while increasing profits for developers. And it goes on to finish up at the end. The size of the cheque is no justification for taking Mike Ashley's financial soup. Cork should be better than this. But Maura, do you blame them? What would you do if you were the Cork County Board and this money came to you?
Well, I think that's the thing. The situation, you can see that it would merit that they're going to look for support, they're going to try. But going back to where you'd said about the taking the soup, I think you just said an interesting way. There's real depth in the article and even the history that goes with it. He had a part where he even mentioned workhouses. From the House of Commons chairman that spoke, Ian Wright said that the working conditions and practices of Sports Direct are closer to that of a Victorian workhouse than that of a modern, reputable high street retailer. So if you were to take that into account and say, well, is that really what you want to be as your sponsor? Is that really who you want to come on board? You'd have to ask the question, is that something that they have tried to improve and change on? As Cliona mentioned, they were in front of the committee. They were brought up as the worst bosses or bad bosses that could be there. But I do think with Cork GAA, they've really tried to reinvent themselves and had a lot of problems, we know, with player strikes and a lot of problems that existed within that county from it. They've come through that strife and kind of turmoil with it as well. And while Eamon Sweeney mentions, I suppose, that it looks they're on the side of the empire rather than the side of the rebels, I think they would be happy to kind of argue that point and say, well, we're going to have a certain amount of autonomy as well. If we take them on board as sponsors, we will be able to push what it is we want to do, where we want to use the money, and maybe in some way impact these work practices and the procedures that Sports Direct have in place.
Cliona, I do sometimes wonder, though, you know, you can understand why people might look at this and be a bit, yeesh, I'm not sure about this one. But if we were to take that puritanical approach to everything, yep. I do sometimes wonder, I know people who still won't shop in Dunn stores, for argument's sake, because of the apartheid argument in the 80s. They're very few, but I do know a few people who still won't, for example. But if you were to boycott everyone that, you know, oppressed, you know, rights or wasn't fair with their employees, we'd be very stuck. And then I wonder, are we picking and choosing how puritanical we are? Or actually, is this case because we have definitive proof and people came out during COVID-19 saying that, you know, Mike Ashley was not treating us well? Is this why maybe we're actually holding on to this and saying this isn't right?
Yeah, I think it's particularly because it's the GA and it is this company that questions were raised and questions have to be asked. But like, you know, lots of us have been buying stuff online, you know, during the lockdown, and you have to worry about the price of things and, you know, their provenance and the care of workers when things can be bought so cheaply nowadays. And sports equipment is, you know, is a classic example of it, I think, or sports wear and clothing. I read a great book this year. It's called Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back. It's by a couple of American women, Jessica Luther and Kavita Davidson, and it was published by the University of Texas. And it's about the subtext of it is the dilemmas of the modern fan. I mean, how do you love a team when, you know, they have a racist mascot, or, you know, they're owned by somebody whose work practices are questionable? And why do we do this? And it is a dilemma for everybody. There's a really good piece in the Mail on Sunday today. I think it's the best piece I've read in the paper today, by Mark Gallagher, on gambling and how it's become worryingly normalised in sport, and how it moved into the space that alcohol sponsors were in, and how it's now so strong and so vivid. And actually, the most important piece about it, I suppose, is he's asking, and Oisin McConville is involved with it, who obviously is well known for being a gambling addict and his opposition to it now. But the question they're asking is why we don't have a regulator, and why it has taken so long to have a regulator for gambling in Ireland. And it's well worth a read. I'm just pointing that out as we're passing in this thing. But this is the dilemma, the intersection of sport with business, because sport, including the GA now, involves so much money.
Yeah.
You know.
And actually, that gambling article there, I think just the figures that stood out for me was it's estimated that the global sports betting market was worth roughly $700 billion in 2019, and soccer accounted for 70% of that, proving it is more of a driver now than horse racing. In the 2018 World Cup, for example, more than $36.4 billion was staked. In that context, it is easy to understand why more than half of the 44 clubs in the Premier League and Championship have a betting company as a shirt sponsor. So that's one argument, Moira, but then you come back like, this is just a sports company with a lot of money who's willing to give Cork money that Cork needs to try and compete, which, as a regular Cork fan, I'm sure they don't want to be thinking about, you know, labour practices and socialism as they're putting on their jersey. But do we have to think about that? And unless we think about this, Moira, things won't change. Or do we need them to change? Is it just us being puritanical sitting on our high horses here? As a text just came in from Dick, I'll tell you right now, he just said, oh, please get off your high horses. Thousands of Irish people, both sporty and non, buy loads of stuff from Sports Direct every year because they're affordable. So if Cork are wrong, so too are all those Irish people, myself included. It must be great to be a holier than thou journalist from Dick, which I totally see his point, Dick. And actually, Dick, there's a lot of people in this country who are surviving on pandemic payments at the moment. And without big chains where you can buy a pair of socks for maybe 3 cents, there's people who would struggle to have clothes on their back this year. So I totally understand that. This is more of a philosophical discussion. We're not saying Cork are right or wrong. We're just discussing it. Sorry, Maud, I interrupted you. I just wanted to say that to Dick. And I'm sure plenty of other Dicks as well.
No, and definitely you can take his point on board and see it. But I suppose in a philosophical sense, I'd always be reminded of the phrase, what's popular isn't always right, and what's right isn't always popular. And it is important to ask the questions of things. But in a big way with Cork, while I would see any player that's going out there to play, any supporter that wants to support them, it may not be the biggest issue from it. But if you let everything go, if you never question anything from it, things don't change and things don't get set in motion, I suppose, to allow a change for it. With Sports Direct, the main thing I would see is that the Cork County Board would have a bit more power in perhaps saying if they have entered the deal from it, and I'm not sure exactly if every team would say they want 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, but they do have a certain amount of power in saying how they would use that money from it. If they certainly felt that there was something ethically wrong, that it was terrible, affecting maybe the image maybe of their own team and of the Cork County, it's something that they could look at from it. But sometimes you nearly need to be within something to change it as well. And that could be a point where you say that if they're involved with Sports Direct, it's something that could be more able to change or more of a possibility to kind of amend the practices.
I'm not sure. I wouldn't share your optimism there that somehow the good people of the Cork County Board could change Mike Ashley when trade unions all over Great Britain couldn't. Like, when you see the beginning of the article, as COVID-19 began to run riot in England last March, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the closure of all non-essential retail outlets. 30 minutes later, Sports Direct emailed all their employees to announce their shops and warehouses would stay open. They also increased prices on sports equipment by up to 50%. Unite Trade Union Regional Officer Cheryl Pidgeon said that the workers at the company's Derbyshire warehouse were threatened with losing their jobs if they self-isolated because of health concerns. The union claimed there was a lack of hand sanitizers and a failure to enforce social distancing. There are many, many scared workers at the warehouse. And maybe, Cliona, that's where it comes down to, that it came down to human life and health. And even when companies all over the world, all over Ireland, all over the UK put on a very good front of, at the very least, acting like they cared, this crowd didn't.
Yeah, and look at it, as I said, these sort of anomalies and these sort of dual standards, they're rife everywhere in sport now, because sport is such a big business, and it doesn't matter whether it's a GA or whether it's Cheltenham or whether, you know, it's the Six Nations. You know, that's bottom line is money. What'll happen is, like what'll happen everywhere else, there will be people in Cork who, you know, feel strongly about this, who probably won't buy the jersey, but will they stop going to Cork games? That's doubtful. But they may not want to wear a jersey that has Sports Direct on it, and that may be the compromise for some people. And given what I was watching on social media during the weekend, there were some prominent Cork businesses who have supported GA in the past. People felt strongly about that and felt that, they would still support them and buy their sports gear from them rather than a big international multinational chain. But, you know, since the collapse of unions, and, you know, God, we could go back into history, in so many businesses, you know, 0 hour contracts are something that are rife in everything, including, as somebody was saying earlier, including supermarkets and all the rest that we use regularly.
If we speak about history, I think it's a good time to move on here. And the hand of history that weighs very, very lightly on Dublin's shoulders. And Maude, there's a lovely interview here with Philip Lanigan with John Small, Dublin's John Small, and his new Baba, who was born on the 2nd of January, which makes it the second best day to be born for the GA calendar, unless you're Michael Foley's new baby boy who was born on New Year's Day. But 2nd of January, and he's talking about what it's like to be a Dubliner, what it's like, the memory of his dad, late dad Declan, and obviously his history with Ballymun as well. It's just a really lovely interview.
It is a very nice piece by Philip Lanigan, and I suppose 6 in a row success has been massive for Dublin, but the title even and the heading with it, the human side to the blue machine, it's lovely to see, I suppose, the heartache that he went through with his father passing away last December. He mentions a lovely part that was done as well, where his father was actually able to get into the Hogan Stand in Crow Park to see, to go to a big game and to be able to attend it, and that it meant a lot to him. So I suppose it's one generation, that it's now a new generation has come along, but he's kind of reminiscing and remembering what had come before. And with all the success that Ballymun Kickhams have had as well, I think it just shows the county board setup and the club standard that has just excelled in recent years in Dublin. And that support from it that really John Small felt he was able to continue to play at such a high level with tough things in his personal life from it. But he definitely seems to have said that it was the perfect timing for a GA baby. So I agree with you there, Martessa.
And actually, well, it's sorry, Cliona, I interrupted you. Go on.
No, well, you probably know this, both of you. The science tells us that babies born in early January have an advantage in sport and often are very successful.
That's why I wasn't keen. I was born at the end of November. That's my excuse.
and I'm a December baby. Thank you very much. I'm even worse than you are. But it's interesting because John Small is a January baby and his baby is a January baby. And there's a nice confluence. But it's a really nice piece as well. And Maura says it rightly because it's a piece also about this notion that Dublin are, you know, buying success. And he talks about Ballymun-Kickhams and their extraordinary legacy, if you like, to Dublin with players in recent years and in the past. And, you know, you're talking about James McCarthy, Philly Mack, Evan Comerford at the moment, the two smalls. Paddy is one of was a really brilliant player this year as well for Dublin. But he's saying that Ballymun actually, they train in a public park pitch. They have an all-weather pitch, but most of their training is done, he's saying, on a public park. And that the club actually, he says, you know, how they've developed in numbers, they only have 170 adult members. They'd even less, I think, and they've just brought in a kind of a junior D team or something. So he's just making the point that, you know, sometimes it's not all about money. It's about people and how they use their resources. And it's a bit of an antidote, I suppose, if you like. You know, and we know people like Paddy Christie and Ian Robertson have done incredible work up there with underage teams, you know, and that's what started the recent thing. So his point is, it's not about money. One of you might have noticed it, but there was definitely something else that jumped out at me and I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, it's not just, you know, they don't appear to be buying success. It's
But obviously, of course, club and county are two very different beasts. But I mean, of all clubs to have the success that Ballymun have had, when you consider the social issues in that area and the fact that they were hemorrhaging players for years to Na Fianna because it was probably nicer, for the want of a better phrase. But just even the line here, the Late Late Show Christmas special featured a host of musicians, including Bono, who once wrote a song about a lack of opportunity in Ballymun, the scourge of heroin in an area that became an unwanted touchstone for social privation with the flats. I see seven towers, but I only see one way out. Remarkable then that the contribution of Ballymun-Kickhams is helping to reframe a community in such a broad, positive light, a beacon of social cohesion and opportunity on the field of play. And that's the power of sport, I suppose. And I suppose that's why more people get kind of angry sometimes when they see things, when they see injustice and unfairness, when they see successful teams from their point of view, they're seeing unsuccessful teams getting more that they're not getting. Now, how can we ever make it up when sport is supposed to be fair and happy?
Yeah, and on that argument, I think really Dublin have set such a high standard in both men and ladies football as well. But the biggest thing that comes from that is really just to try and raise yourself to that standard, to achieve the challenge of it. And while it is tough, and I understand there's a lot of barriers that stand in the way of different counties, and especially with clubs as well, I don't think you can really say that it's unfair that somebody has achieved such a high level of success and they need to be taken down from that pedestal then. But when we mentioned Paddy Christie there as well earlier, like, he organised and paid kind of sometimes from his own money to get buses where they'd bring them to matches, where they'd, you know, maybe buy them a bottle of Lucozade on the way home. And it was to create kind of that social or that community scene from it. And that's evident, like the first county title in 8 years for Ballymun-Kickhams, a huge thing for them to achieve. But those players have then gone on and represented their county in the same way. James McCarthy was exceptional against Mayo and the All-Ireland. Dean Rock, again, flawless with his free taking. And I think when you look at the effort that has been put in, it shows from a club level, they go back to maybe a disadvantaged area that really has pushed itself to show how the GA and how community can help to improve that and invigorate an area as well.
And MT, I found that piece. I was trying to remember. I knew there was something in it. He says that Brendan Hackett, who is their club manager, he says he bought their gear bags this year out of his own pocket because the club didn't have the money to get us gear. So, like, that is, you know, we hear so much about money in Dublin. Yes, you know, the development officers and the coaching people that have gone into schools and clubs, obviously they have affected, you know, standards and quality and technique and skill. But, you know, at a club level, you know, that's a really interesting fact to know, because it does give a bit of a lie to the fact that, you know, they're not.
Is that why, Cliona, do you think that so many clubs around the country have a shot at All-Ireland success? You know, obviously Corrifin, my own county being, but because while the Dublin money machine, and we may as well call it that, has reaped great reward in combination with lots of other things in the county, it hasn't filtered down to club, and that has left club as a more level playing field.
Yes, and look, success breeds success, and culture breeds culture, you know. And we look at somewhere like Corrifin, do you know what I mean? Where, you know, you know, it's the next generation of boys whose fathers played and got to an All-Ireland club final and won it. They were, you know, not expected to back in the early 90s. And so many of their kids have come through now. So many of those, also some of those guys are involved with the teams now. Like, club culture is very different. It's about having brilliant people involved in your club and brilliant families involved in your club. And it's not always about money. It's about people.
Maura, you're a Milltown woman, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, so how does Cara Finn success sit with you guys in Milltown?
They do well, but there's definitely a huge rivalry there. And I suppose we're still looking forward to having Frank Fox come to the blue and white when that day arrives. But just on the point where Cliona was making there, and I suppose on the promotion of Dublin, I was reading in Bernard Brogan's book, The Hill. One of the points he made was when Jim Gavin came in, that he introduced partnerships that are now a huge part of the Dublin setup and the county teams. They have over 16 companies that they are in partnership with. So it ranges from food, from insurance, transport. And it basically was that they went and searched for it. They went and asked. And Cara Finn are in another example of that. They would have maybe 200,000, 250,000 of expenditure that they would have had. But they again entered into partnership with different, rather than just one sponsor. They asked and figured, well, how can we get this money together? How can we help our teams to achieve better, to have more facilities for them? And I think that's a huge thing, that rather than something being handed to you or expect that because others have gotten it, it should be fair for everyone to have it. You need to work. You need to kind of have the initiative to go and ask. And maybe it won't work immediately, but another company can come on board. And those partnerships in club and county have proven successful for those teams.
But you can see as well, Maura, how that could get people listening to saying, you know, that's unfair. It should be fairer than that. Like, you shouldn't have to go with your hand out to get what other people have.
Yeah, and I suppose it's just in life in general, you do have to work for things from it. Sometimes it can happen in that way, but the teams who push and the people who are successful and individuals, there is something extra that pushes them over the line. And sometimes it can be a bit of luck, but I think, you know, you have to try and make your own luck as well. And if you see a formula that's working, something that's going to be a winning formula from it, you don't have to copy it exactly, but you definitely need to try and take something from it to try and emulate it in your own way.
Cliona, were you about to butt in there with something?
Yeah, haven't I always, as you? I mean, it strikes me as well, like, you know, and it isn't really talked about much, but like, nobody objected to the Cork women when they were dominating women's football as much, because it wasn't seen that they had extra resources or more of an advantage than anybody else. That's the problem for Dublin now, is that they're seen to get a lot of money from Croke Park, and people are saying, hold on, they don't need it. We need it more. There's where the argument comes from.
Look, we could be sitting here having that discussion for the rest of the afternoon, and indeed about the rest of sports pages. There is a lot in there, including a piece we didn't manage to get to, but I think if you are interested in the Sunday Times, Paul Rowan has a lovely piece about Pádraig Amond, who always comes up in the papers this time of year with the FA Cup. There's loads more in the papers, but I'm afraid our time with this section of the show has had to come to an end. Cliona Foley, August Moore, and Eve Raylan, thank you very, very much for joining us. And do stay with us. We've got lots more coming right up.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein powered chicken bites.